I hope everybody listening to this saw the end of SmackDown this week. And if you didn't, stop listening to this podcast and go back and watch the last 5 minutes of the show from Friday. Absolute magic. This is episode 276 of the Solid Monster Sounds Off on SEScoops.com and Stitcher Radio here for Sunday, June 2nd, 2013. I am the Solid Monster. The absolute greatest thing in wrestling right now is the Daniel Bryan babyface comeback. He is, without exaggeration, the best performer in WWE right now. And he's got momentum. And they need to make the most of it. Has to be him and Cena in the main event at SummerSlam for the WWE Championship. And I'm hearing this idea that they may want to turn him heel. You can kind of see it going in that direction with all the squabbling with Kane. You know, Bryan thinking that he's the weak link of the team and all that. All I can say is, if they were to turn Daniel Bryan heel right now, it would be sheer insanity. I mean, they could still do a Cena-Bryan program with Bryan as the heel, and Bryan could be an awesome heel. We've seen that before, although not to his full potential. He could be an even better heel than he was before. But I just think it would be criminal to do that turn right now with all the momentum he has. In fact, if anybody was going to turn, and I know this isn't going to happen, I know they won't do it, but they've got a great story to tell if they wanted to with John Cena being the one to turn in a program with Bryan. You've got a babyface versus babyface, you know, Cena versus Bryan dynamic right now. So naturally you'd have Cena, as he always does, being very complimentary towards his opponent. Sometimes it's very annoying when he does that, but very complimentary towards Bryan. All seems fine going into the pay-per-view. They have a kick-ass match. I have no doubt with the crowd reaction and the action in the ring, they could have a classic, you know, the same way that Punk and Cena did back in Money in the Bank. When the stars align, you got two guys in the ring that could go. I mean, the sky's the limit. You know, Cena's real good when he has to be. He can carry his own when he's in there with a good worker. And you could do a disputed finish in the first match. Maybe the Shield gets involved or nobody gets involved. But Bryan, you know, takes Cena to the limit. It's only the first match of the program. But you could start to see where Cena feels threatened by Bryan, let's say in storyline. The fact that he barely beat him or, you know, beat him under dubious circumstances. The crowd reactions to Bryan are far stronger than Cena's over the course of time, let's say. And all of a sudden, happy-go-lucky John Cena isn't so happy-go-lucky with Bryan anymore. You know, or he is, but he seems awfully disingenuous about it. And at some point, whether it's the second match, the third match, you do the turn because for the first time in the last 8 years, John Cena finally sees his top spot being threatened by somebody else. You know, for a while there, Cena couldn't buy a win to save his life over CM Punk, and Punk had the title for over a year, but Punk and Cena are two totally different dudes when it comes to their personalities and all the stuff outside the ring that they do. But Bryan, you know, he's out there doing more and more publicity for the company and charity stuff and all that. He's a genuinely likable guy. The kids can get behind him. You know, Cena's never been up against anyone like this before. And, you know, that story can take you through the rest of the year. And if they did turn Cena, even though they're already short on top babyfaces, you've got Bryan essentially taking his place. So it's a wash. It's not like, well, you turn Cena and all of a sudden you're down one babyface. No, you know, Bryan takes his spot, so you're not losing anything on the babyface side. But, you know, it opens up a whole host of potential matches heading into 2014. The only drawback is it kills the dynamic of an Undertaker-John Cena match at WrestleMania. I think that would work best if Cena were a babyface. But you've got WWE pushing a guy like Sheamus as the number two babyface in the company who is not over as a number two babyface. And meanwhile, they're leaving a ton of money on the table by not booking Bryan in a top position. So it's just an idea. I know they're not going to turn Cena. I'm just saying the story is there if they wanted to grab onto it. You know, if they were to turn Daniel Bryan heel, which they could very well do, I think, again, it's sheer insanity given the reactions he's getting right now. But that wouldn't be the worst thing in the world either. You know, I'm not going to say they'd be stupid for it. Anything to get Bryan in that top spot, heel or face, I'm fine with. But you watch the reactions that he's been getting. You watch Raw Monday, the end of SmackDown Friday, it's exciting because the guy is on the cusp. You know, he's just about there. He just needs that little extra push there, and he could be something special. And on Raw Monday night, you know, he tore the house down in a tag team title match with Kane. against Seth Rollins and Roman Reigns. And like last week, they gave that match a lot of time, about 20 minutes. And it was awesome. You know, just a fantastic pro wrestling match with great action, where everyone comes out of it looking better than they did going in. And the story here was that Bryan was a bit overzealous. He was trying to prove that he wasn't the weak link of the team, which he would go on to do on Friday. And in the end, he inadvertently distracted Kane. Rollins caught him with a knee to the side of the head, pinned Kane. But I love this. I thought it just fantastic segment. It was Bret Hart Appreciation Night in Calgary on Monday. So earlier in the show, they did a backstage segment with the Hitman and Team Hell No. And Bret gave this great pep talk to Daniel Bryan about how great he thinks he is. And Bryan just had this look on his face like he was spellbound by what he had just heard. And meanwhile, you know, Kane had just been telling him the same thing, and Bryan didn't bother listening to him. So Kane is asking him, you know, why is it that, you know, if Bret Hart says the same thing to you that I said, it has an impact, but you don't listen to me? And Bryan said, that's Bret the Hitman Hart, the best there is, the best there was, the best there ever will be. And you, well, you're just Kane. And the crowd popped. I thought it was a great line. Then, again, you move on to SmackDown on Friday. It was a series of matches, actually. It started with Kane and Seth Rollins, who had a pretty good match. Bryan then immediately went into a match with Roman Reigns, which I believe ended in a DQ. Kane pinned Rollins with a chokeslam. And the main event was Randy Orton and Dean Ambrose, which had the potential to be a classic and probably will be one day, but they didn't really give it that much time. And the end of the show, as I alluded to before, Daniel Bryan single-handedly destroys the Shield at the end of the show, and every single fan in that building is throwing their hands up in the air and shouting yes over and over again. And if this were any other segment on SmackDown, from what little of SmackDown each week that I see, because, and the reason being, the crowd sweetening, it's just unbearable. I feel like they use it when they don't even have to. They just feel compelled to use it. Well, not here. No crowd sweetening necessary here. It was just an amazing scene, and it was one that I wish had aired on Raw Monday night so that more people could have seen it. If you miss SmackDown, again, as I do probably more often than I should, just do yourself a favor. At least watch the end of the show. You watch that and, you know, you hear the rumors of Bryan turning heel. You'll ask yourself why those same people thinking of doing that aren't in straitjackets. But, again, this guy's the hottest babyface in the company right now. He should be booked like. And the truth is, it's true. You know, if John Cena had been booked to wipe out the Shield in this segment all by himself, people would be talking about how, oh, he buried the Shield, but it's just because people are tired of Cena. You know, they're tired of the Superman booking. In Bryan, they see somebody fresh who doesn't reek of the same old stuff, who's over. You know, I guarantee you, if this were the Attitude Era, and it was Steve Austin in there giving stunners to Rollins and Reigns and Ambrose, they wouldn't be talking about how Steve Austin had just buried the Shield. You know, they'd be going crazy like they were on Friday and throwing up their middle fingers. And I'd like to think that in a way, what we saw on Friday was the current audience essentially throwing up their middle fingers at WWE and endorsing change at the top. You know, they like this guy. Let's do something with him. And it looks like they are. And I think that's pretty cool. The big stories coming out of Raw this past Monday night, John Cena and Ryback have had their match at Payback changed from an ambulance match to a three stages of hell match, one of which will be an ambulance match. The other two will be lumberjack and a tables match. And it makes me scratch my head because I don't really know what the purpose of this is. I'm seeing these reports on SE Scoops and other sites saying that Vince McMahon reportedly changed the match because he wants to do something epic with John Cena. I don't know about you. I think the idea I just suggested before with Bryan would be pretty epic. You know, you could even have Bryan out there as one of the lumberjacks in the first fall, you know, accidentally cost Cena the fall somehow, and then Cena wins the next two, and now you've planted the seeds for his next feud heading into SummerSlam, you know, with Bryan having nearly cost him the championship. As far as Ryback is concerned, my only guess here is that they want to give Ryback a winning fall. You know, typically in these kinds of matches, one person wins one fall, then the other person wins, so you go to a third fall. To beat Ryback twice would almost be comical, just because he's been beaten every single other pay-per-view. Even last month, you know, at Extreme Rules, you could argue that he lost, and that the idea was that he's wrestling for the WWE Championship, and he was unsuccessful. And as I pointed out on a recent Sound Off, you go back to Ryback's first big pay-per-view match against CM Punk in October. He lost at Hell in a Cell. He lost at Survivor Series. He lost at TLC. He was eliminated by Cena at the Rumble. He lost at the Chamber. He lost to Mark Henry at WrestleMania for reasons that are still unexplained to me. He didn't get the job done at Extreme Rules. And so here he is in yet another championship match on pay-per-view, and now he's got the opportunity to lose not once but twice on the same show. I would think they're not going to do that. My guess would be Cena wins the Lumberjack, Ryback wins the tables, and they go to the ambulance match, and Cena ultimately disposes of him. But it's just very odd to me that they would make this change. I don't really know that it was necessary. I mean, they already announced the ambulance stip, but I guess that Vince McMahon must have something in mind. Yeah, it's funny, when they mentioned three stages of hell, they mentioned on commentary Monday night that there had been three of them previously. This will be the fourth such match in WWE history. And at that moment, I literally could only remember one, and that is the first one, which was Steve Austin and Triple H the month before WrestleMania back in 2001. And if you recall, they had a pretty awesome match. Triple H won, and Austin went on the next month to win the championship. So I don't know if that was just done as a way to kind of keep Triple H happy, given that, you know, he was going to lose to The Undertaker at WrestleMania and Austin was going to get the title. Because Triple H, who knows what they would have done had he not torn his quad a few months later, but it's not like, you know, Triple H beat Austin and then had this great excuse coming out of WrestleMania why he deserved a title shot. It was just kind of odd they put the two of them together as a tag team and Triple H never got his shot. But that was the only one I could remember off the top of my head. And then, as you all reminded me, there was the Triple H Shawn Michaels one at the Armageddon pay-per-view in 2002, which was, I forgot what the first fall was. I know the second was Cage and the third was Ladder. That was pretty good. I remember at the time thinking that the crowd was kind of dead for much of that match, so it took it down a few notches. And Shawn Michaels took that absolutely insane bump off the ladders, out of the ring, through like two or three stacked tables on the outside. It's a great visual. It was insane for him to do, 3 months after he came back from the back injury. That was right after he came back at SummerSlam that year. So there was that one, and I got to tell you, the third one apparently was Triple H and Randy Orton had a three stages of hell match back in 2009. I have absolutely no recollection of this whatsoever. I know that Orton and Triple H had their WrestleMania match, which sucked, back in 2009, I know that they had a match at the Royal Rumble, I believe it was in 2005. That was when they were doing the concussion gimmick with Randy Orton, which was great. And then Triple H went on to face Batista. So I know they've had a whole bunch of matches. I have no memory of that whatsoever. I still don't. I haven't bothered to look it up. But apparently that was the last three stages of Hell match that we had. The other big news coming out of Raw Monday night, apparently CM Punk is returning at Payback in Chicago in a match against Chris Jericho. Now, I scribbled here in my notes, or is he? And the reason I wrote that down was the way this whole segment kind of unfolded on Monday night, it was a highlight reel segment. Chris Jericho had Paul Heyman on as his guest. And the funny thing about that is, you know, early in the show they announced, you know, tonight Chris Jericho will grill Paul Heyman on the highlight reel. And my first thought, as I tweeted out, was, I wonder if I'll ask him where his money is from 1995. And sure enough, that was one of the first things Jericho brought up in the promo, you owe me money, as Paul Heyman does owe money to many people. But I was skeptical. I was left skeptical if this match would actually happen. Now, to advertise it, especially in Chicago, no less, Punk's hometown, and have Punk no-show would not be wise. Plus, it would be false advertising. But, you know, I don't know. Just the way this whole segment went down, Heyman speaking on Punk's behalf, you know, basically Jericho goaded Heyman into agreeing on behalf of CM Punk to a match. Obviously, Punk wasn't there to speak for himself, and I sense Heyman's acceptance of Jericho's challenge is the first step in the breakup of CM Punk and Paul Heyman. I hope the match does happen. I'm pretty sure it will, but again, I was a little skeptical at first just because I could see Heyman saying, yeah, okay, you know, my client CM Punk will be there, and then Punk doesn't show, or, you know, he shows up in street clothes, and maybe they have, like, a fight, but not an actual match. But I hope it does happen, because, you know, Punk in Chicago is going to get a monster reaction, and a match with Jericho with a hot crowd could steal the show. So, you know, as a wrestling fan, I hope they do have a match. And then we have the Wyatt family vignette. The first vignette aired on television to hype the arrival of Bray Wyatt, Luke Harper, and Eric Rowan. Bray Wyatt would be the first of the three NXT call-ups I predicted for 2013 right here on the Sound Off. The other two were Corey Graves and Cassius Ohno. And I, for one, cannot wait. I think Bray Wyatt is money. I think it's long overdue. I still think, quite frankly, he never should have been sent back down to developmental in the first place. You could argue the Husky Harris name maybe was not the best name in the world, although WWE has given far worse names to people. But, you know, the guy was, he had a unique look at the time. He was a big, husky guy, I guess, and they even had a nickname for him at the time. They used to call him the Army Tank with a Ferrari engine. And it was just nice having somebody on the active roster that didn't look like everybody else. He seemed like a decent enough wrestler. And they took him off TV, I guess, because they wanted him to lose weight, which, you know, we've heard this song and dance with people before. And, you know, in the end it worked out because he latched onto this character. It just felt like they didn't know what they wanted to do with him. For a time in developmental, you know, he had a mask on. They put a mask on him. They were trying a masked character with him. And eventually they settled into this Bray Wyatt character. So again, in the end, it all worked out. But long overdue to get him back on TV. And it looks like he'll be bringing his family with him. As one of our listeners, Tony, said in an email to me, he says, the character is basically Waylon Mercy mixed in with Jim Jones, which is quite the frightening combination. And Tony thought the masks in that vignette that the other members of the family were wearing reminded him of the masks that the Joker's thugs wore in The Dark Knight. It actually reminded me of that pig mask from the Saw movies. I mean, either way, it was creepy as all hell. I loved it. So, no indication of when he'll be back on television. Obviously, it'll probably be a few weeks. I would imagine they're not going to put him on TV this week. So we'll probably get a few more weeks of these vignettes, and whether it's Raw or SmackDown, I think it's all one and the same now. So I'm sure he'll be on Raw, and I think it'll be great. I think that it's about time we get some more fresh talent brought up, and the more the merrier. I am completely in favor of it. Some other notes from Raw Monday night. The Triple H storyline now, the update is that he suffered no neurological injuries. And in fact, the way they were talking, Triple H is perfectly fine. And he may even be back on television as early as this week. So that finished, I guess, with Curtis Axel last week. After all that, he's fine. Perfectly okay. So I assume there's more to this story, so we'll let it play out and see where it goes. My opinion, Triple H should not be on television. Except for one or two matches a year, and to hype up those matches, there's no reason. There's no point for Triple H to be on television unless they specifically want to use him to help put somebody over. And it's a really odd way of putting Curtis Axel over so far, the way they used him in that first night. But it's one night, one match. Maybe they're going to bring Triple H back. Maybe it'll be Triple H and Curtis Axel part two at the pay-per-view. And they'll actually have time to go out there and have a nice match. And Triple H will put him over. And we'll all look foolish for thinking otherwise. I don't know if that's what's going to take place. But they got something in mind for Triple H. So we'll have to see where they go with it. It was a backstage segment with John Cena and Shawn Michaels' beard. A mighty beard he's growing. And HBK was there for the Bret Hart ceremony, which came later on, so I guess they just felt the need to stick him on TV in a completely meaningless segment. You know, he was there, I think the point was he was trying to convince John Cena, who was booked to face Curtis Axel in the main event, that he did not have to take the match. I guess because Cena was coming off the injury angle at Extreme Rules, so HBK didn't want him to risk his health. Which makes absolutely no sense, given that John Cena not one time sold any sort of injury on this show, even the night he got hurt. Remember, he refused an ambulance, he took off the neck brace and walked off on his own power. He shows up at the beginning of Raw this week, smiling, as always, moving around perfectly fine, not showing any signs of injuries whatsoever. And then he wrestled in the main event, and he looked perfectly fine there, too. So this was just an excuse to get Shawn Michaels on TV, and basically was a complete waste of the man on the show. Dean Ambrose had a match against Kofi Kingston, United States Championship rematch, and pretty one-sided affair. Ambrose won with his drilling DDT finish, which just looked brutal. So good match. There was one thing I have to just say from that awesome tag team title match that I have to take issue with here. They have three announcers now on Monday Night Raw, and I actually like the announce team of Michael Cole, JBL, and Jerry Lawler, largely because I think JBL, he makes for a good anchor, I think, between the two of them, and he maybe cuts down on some of the announce time for Lawler, which is probably for the better. So I like the announce team, the three-man booth, but you've got these three guys who are normally very good, and you've got Bret the Hitman Hart in the house, no less, in Calgary. And not one of them, not Cole, not Lawler, not JBL, points out that Team Hell No, in the course of this match, used the Hart Foundation's old heart attack finisher. That's inexcusable. I'm just sitting there thinking to myself, I can't believe not one of them made reference to it. And I saw other people, wrestlers on Twitter, Shane Helms and a few other people, say the exact same thing that I was thinking. How could you not have one? You have three guys sitting there calling this match, and not one of them picks up on that. In Canada with Bret Hart backstage. Just amazes me. During the show Monday night, they advertised a tag team match for main event on ION this week that I believe was supposed to be Sheamus and Miz against Wade Barrett and Fandango. And as soon as they put that graphic up, I tweeted, "Don't believe anything you hear on Raw about matches on main event. It'll change three times by tomorrow morning." And remember when they promised a title match for main event between Wade Barrett and Sin Cara a couple weeks ago? Never happened. Well, surprise, surprise, they changed their minds again. And instead, on main event this week, we got a singles match between Barrett and Sheamus that I hear was actually really freaking great. I have not had a chance to watch it. I also hear they have a new announce team for main event of Josh Matthews, The Miz, and Ricardo Rodriguez. So if anybody watched the show, let me know how Ricardo was. If he's any good, all I can say is there anything this man can't do? You know, he wrestles, he manages, he ring announces, now he's a commentator. It's too bad he's not a magician, too, so he could wave his wand and make the people care about Alberto Del Rio. Divas stopwatch this week was 3 minutes and 41 seconds, which is actually quite long. Natalia, poor Natalia, loses on her birthday. It was her birthday on Monday, in her hometown of Calgary, no less. So anyone who is surprised by this obviously has not been paying attention. That's what they do to people. They beat them in their hometown. Main event was John Cena and Curtis Axel. And unfortunately, for a good chunk of this, there was a massive fight going on in the crowd, so you could see where the camera guys did not want to shoot what was going on in the audience. The wrestlers were distracted, the people were distracted. At one point, John Cena was kind of mouthing, "Hey, the real fight's in here." So that kind of took away from the match a little bit. It really wasn't much of a match, to be honest with you. At some point during the match, all of a sudden we heard an ambulance siren blaring. It sped right into the arena. This apparently was enough to distract John Cena, who probably looked and said, "Ooh, pretty colors," and he ran outside the ring to go after this ambulance, not realizing the entire time that the referee was counting him out, which is ultimately what happened. John Cena opened the doors to the ambulance, didn't see anybody in there. The bell rung, and it was announced that John Cena had been counted out. Of course, Ryback did end up attacking Cena from behind, and much like the week before, Curtis Axel, even getting a win, is a complete afterthought. I think Michael Cole said it best at the end of this show when he said, and I quote, "We all forgot about Curtis Axel." That's what he said, because the focus was on Cena and Ryback and the attack that was going on there, and it's almost like, oh, this guy won the match. We almost forgot. So prophetic words right there. I think that really just says it all. Also, no Raw appearance yet again, second week in a row for Antonio Cesaro, who instead lost to R-Truth in a match that was taped for Superstars at the beginning of the night. In fact, he's losing on the house shows to R-Truth as well. They had a match in Glens Falls, New York, on Friday night with the same result. It's just absolutely maddening. Bret Hart Appreciation Night. They were hyping throughout the entire night that the only way to see it would be on the WWE app when the show was over. And it's a clever move to promote the app, I will say, but I still find it rather funny that 3 hours of television is not enough time to air the Bret Hart stuff, which in fact was some of the best stuff. You know, the tag team title match I enjoyed more, but that aside, this was the best thing of the entire night, and it didn't even air on TV. And I would be very curious to know how many people actually did download the app and tune into it. Maybe they got a whole bunch of people to do it. I don't really understand the purpose. Are they making money off it? It's not a paid app. It's a free app. So I just don't really see what's being gained here. It's a clever way to get people to download your stuff, but this should have been on TV. It was very cool. It wasn't actually as not nice, but I guess it wasn't quite what I thought it would be. It didn't stack up as well to some of these other tribute stuff they've done before. Like the Ric Flair thing, obviously, is far and away the best thing they've ever done. And they really spared no expense to bring everybody in, from whether it was Steamboat or Harley Race or the Horsemen. Flair's family was there. A lot of current guys from the roster came out to pay their respects. Even when that show was over, you know, Undertaker came out and basically broke character to pay tribute to Ric Flair. Vince McMahon came out, all that stuff. This wasn't quite as large or as involved. They basically had Pat Patterson. Chris Jericho came back out. Shawn Michaels was there for the purposes of this ceremony. And Vince McMahon were the special guests who all appeared. I was very surprised they didn't bring out any Hart family members. I didn't know if they were going to bring out any of the brothers. I didn't think the Anvil would be there. I thought maybe there was a slight chance because, you know, they were paying tribute to Bret Hart and his daughter was wrestling on the show. I know Anvil has had some issues in the not-too-recent past. I know he was even incarcerated at one point. I don't believe he is anymore. Maybe he's in rehab. I hope he's doing okay. But he wasn't there, so that kind of surprised me. But, you know, overall it was nice. Jerry Lawler was there hosting the whole thing. He read this really long, never-ending proclamation. I think it was from the mayor of Calgary, honoring Bret. And, you know, they exchanged some nice pleasantries. And it was funny, too, because Pat Patterson came out and paid tribute to Bret. And I think Pat said something to the effect of Bret was the best Canadian wrestler to ever come out of the country and all this stuff. And Pat got down on his knee at one point. And Bret Hart made a comment about how I always get nervous whenever Pat gets down on one knee. And people laughed, and it was funny. It was a funny line. Well, Bret went on Twitter a couple days after Raw, and he actually issued an apology. He said, "I sincerely apologize to anyone that was in any way offended by my in-ring joke to Pat Patterson on Monday, especially to Pat, whom I hold in the highest regard. I was only trying to make, take some of the edge off the emotionally challenging moment, and I failed. The comment does not in any way reflect my feelings towards the gay and lesbian community." You know, I talked even recently about some stuff that happens in wrestling that is pretty offensive. You know, the Bully Ray stuff, Bully Ray, even as a heel, using the kind of words that he used on a fan in the crowd was pretty freaking stupid. Austin Aries, you know, basically sticking his crotch in Christy Hemme's face when she wasn't okay with that or aware of it or anything like that. That's not cool. Something like this, this is where, you know, you talk about the PC police. Obviously, there were people on Twitter or whatever who probably said to Bret, "Oh, I'm offended by that joke." Get over yourselves. I mean, obviously, there was no ill will meant towards it. It was a throwaway line. He didn't use any offensive language. You know, just get over it. You know, this is not anything to get upset about. This is the sort of thing where Bret Hart didn't have to apologize. I mean, come on. This is ridiculous. But anyway, I guess he felt compelled to do so, and so he went and did that. But the ceremony had Chris Jericho sharing a story that I think he may have had in his book. It's been a while since I read both of his books, so I don't really remember. But it's a great story about, as a young wrestler back in 95, he was sharing a locker room at an event with Bret Hart, and Bret was trying to come up with a finish to his in-your-house pay-per-view title match with Davey Boy Smith. They had a really bloody, really great WWE Championship match in December of 95, and he just didn't know, you know, he wanted to do something different for the finish, and Jericho piped up and said, "Well, basically, I have a move that you can try," and it was the La Magistral Cradle, if you remember, that Bret finished off Bulldog in that match with, which kind of came out of nowhere. You know, Bret even asked Jericho to go ahead and kind of show the move to him so he can get a sense of what it was. And then 2 days later, in the pay-per-view match, he used the move, and Jericho just thought that was so cool that somebody who at the time was the WWF champion, you know, he was the biggest guy in the business on top of the world, would actually listen to and take advice from in a move from somebody who was a nobody, basically, at that time. So that was kind of a cool story for him to share. But overall, it was very nice. You know, Shawn Michaels said that, you know, everybody has their own villain to kind of counteract them. You know, Batman had the Joker, Superman had Lex Luthor, and I'm your Lex Luthor, and I'm honored to have been that. And they shook hands, and Bret had this look on his face when they kind of hugged, like, he didn't want to be hugging the guy. It was the same look Bret had on his face back when he came back on Raw in 2010, and he called out Shawn Michaels, and the two of them ended up hugging. And Bret, look, it was like the fakest hug you'll ever see. I know the two of them get along well. They're actually friends now, and they text each other, and they did a signing together here in New York WrestleMania weekend. But he just had this look on his face like, you know, don't touch me. But it was nice. It was a nice thing, and very cool to see. Tyson Kidd came out, so he's doing well, recovering from knee surgery. He was there with Natalya in the ring. The two of them are an item. They are not related, as I had two people email me thinking that they were brother and sister. They are not. They are, in fact, boyfriend and girlfriend. So, really cool stuff. Should have been on TV. I caught NXT again this week, 2 weeks in a row. Very proud of myself. And enjoyed it. Thoroughly enjoyed NXT this week. Stephanie McMahon had her major earth-shattering announcement that she made from the studios in Stamford. And she did, in fact, announce that there is a new NXT Women's Championship. She said women's, not divas, so I assume it's going to be called the women's title. That not only the NXT divas will be able to wrestle for, but they'll also bring in some WWE divas, I guess, at the NXT tapings to participate in, I don't know if it's a tournament, I don't remember what format she said it would take, but they're going to crown a new women's champion. Bo Dallas won I think it was 17-man Battle Royal to become the number one contender to Big E Langston's NXT Championship. We had Big E also wrestling. He beat Derek Bateman. His five-count gimmick that he stole from King Kong Bundy could be a great way to turn him babyface on TV when they get there. And they kind of teased it, actually. I think it was on Raw this week that Langston lost, and there was some dissension post-match with him and AJ. So they're already teasing something there. But I think that five-count gimmick would really get over well on TV. Emma was on this show in action against Audrey Marie. Now, you may remember last week when I talked about NXT, there was a backstage segment with the two of them, and I said, Emma, I didn't get it. You know, it just seemed like she was all right. Audrey Marie was pretty good in her role, and yet Audrey Marie is the one that they cut recently. And I just didn't understand why. I didn't understand the appeal to Emma. Well, Emma came out this week, and she's got this dancing gimmick. She's a really bad dancer, and she's got this really freaky, almost hypnotic theme music. And I get it now, because I was getting into it just like the people in the building were getting into it. She's got something with this dancing gimmick and the theme music. The key is that when they bring her to the main roster, they have to let her keep that theme music, because I've got this damn theme stuck in my head now. It's very catchy. So I get it now. I see what the appeal is, and I think there's potential there. Jake Carter was in action on this show in a tag team match. He is the son of Vader and a dead ringer for The Miz. I mean, if you look at this guy, he looks nothing like his father and looks everything like The Miz. It's just weird how much he looks like The Miz. That was what I noticed. And there were actually a lot of names on this show that were released, you know, because these shows are taped weeks in advance. So, you know, they had Audrey Marie. They had Derek Bateman, who also got cut. Sakamoto was in the Battle Royal. I think he was the first one dumped out. He got cut. Brandon Traven, who apparently was a trainee of the Hall of Famer, legendary Harley Race. He was in that tag match, actually, that included Jake Carter. He got cut recently. So, you know, it's kind of like The Sixth Sense here. I see dead people all over this show. But I enjoyed it, and like I said, I want to try to make it a weekly ritual to watch NXT, because I've just, you know, I just haven't had the time, and I may not have the time every single week, but it really is genuinely a really good professional wrestling show, and you get to see a lot of the talent that eventually will migrate up to the main roster. You really are seeing the future stars of tomorrow today. It's kind of a cheesy line, but I just came up with that myself, but it's good action. You know, if you just like a good old-fashioned wrestling show that kind of reminds you of those old studio wrestling shows, because, you know, at Full Sail University, it's not like a big arena. I mean, maybe they have 500 people there, I'm guessing. So it's a nice, intimate environment, even more so than the Impact Zone was in Orlando. I think that probably was twice the size of this place. But, you know, good show this week. I enjoyed it. Some other WWE notes to go through here real quick. Kofi Kingston had elbow surgery on Thursday. Should only have been a minor operation. I haven't heard anything since. So he was expected to be out for up to 2 months, so he won't be gone for too long. I do have to say, Ryback's destruction of Kofi on SmackDown Friday night, he put Kofi Kingston through three tables to kind of build up the tables match part of his pay-per-view battle with John Cena. It really made Ryback look like a legit monster. It was actually really good stuff, and maybe this will give Kofi a purpose when he comes back if he wants to go after Ryback. So I thought that was good stuff. WWE announced this week that they are teaming up with Warner Brothers to co-produce a Flintstones animated movie to be released in early 2015. Fred, Barney, and the whole Bedrock gang, it says, join up with, you'll like this, Vince McMagma, John Cena Stone, and CM Punk Rock as part of the very first WWE main event. That's what the press release says. And here's a quote from Michael Luisi. He's the president of WWE Studios. He says, WWE is family-friendly entertainment, so partnering with Warner Brothers on a Flintstone WWE project was a natural extension of our Scooby-Doo deal. Remember, the Scooby-Doo movie is coming out soon, too. This new animated feature allows us to showcase our brand with young fans and loyal Flintstones enthusiasts alike. Now, keep that in mind when you hear these numbers I'm about to recite to you. This is regarding WWE's television audience. This comes from actually the Wrestling Observer newsletter this week, which is just ironic that these numbers were published in the newsletter this week when this news came out. Now, keep in mind, this is TV audience, not live event audience, but this is the makeup for 2013 so far of the WWE audience. 18% of their fans are ages 2 through 17. 24% are age 18 to 34. 22% age 35 to 49. And 33% of their audience is age 50 and up. And remember, there were way more kids watching during the Attitude Era, the TV 14 era, than there are today. But you'd never know it based on how they market their product. You know, maybe they figured the big payoff will come in another 10 years or so. Just kind of bide your time and wait. And then a decade from now, when these kids are in high school, things get hot again like they did, you know, 15 years ago. Maybe that's their logic. I don't know. But I read the news about the Flintstones deal. I saw those numbers about their TV audience, and it's quite the contrast between the two. It really is. And finally, one last note here. I watched Randy Orton's new film, 12 Rounds 2 Reloaded. Why they had to put the number 2 in there instead of just calling it 12 Rounds Reloaded, I don't know. But I've seen the film, and I have to say, I enjoyed it. I enjoyed it for what it was. You know, Orton is no master thespian. He's not the best actor I've ever seen, but he did fine. There was some good action. It had kind of a Die Hard 3 or a Speed vibe to it. You know, the original, not the crappy one on the boat. And those were two fine movies. I'd say as a rental, you can't go wrong. You know, the DVD actually doesn't come out until this Tuesday, so if you are on the fence, if you sometimes check out these WWE movies and you like good action, I'd say, you know, check it out. Orton did an interview with IGN.com this week to promote the movie, and he was asked about all the new talent being brought up to the main roster. He had this great line I wanted to share about Curtis Axel. Okay, this is what Randy Orton said. He said, I think there's been a lot of pressure on Joe Hennig just being the son of Mr. Perfect. I mean, how could there not be a lot of pressure? And that whole Michael McGillicuddy thing, that was just career suicide. He made it through that, and I think anyone who can make it through something like that, having a name like McGillicuddy for however many years he had it, is a survivor. So you see, we're not the only ones who think those crappy names were really crappy. The wrestlers feel the same way. They're doing a better job, I have to say, with the names now, thankfully. But, you know, who knows how many careers were killed off because of all those crappy names they were dishing out a few years ago in developmental. Let's shift over to TNA, and if you don't normally listen to the TNA section, if you're not really much of a TNA fan, I would urge you to listen anyway this week because there's some important points I'm going to hit on here in a second. First things first, some get well wishes to the Hulkster, who suffered some pretty horrific burns to his hand after a radiator exploded on his boat. He posted a whole bunch of photos on Twitter that are just really disgusting. Enough so that he has since apologized for posting them. He said, "I now realize I should take a moment before I make a decision." I would have thought he'd have already figured that out last year after he retweeted that guy who said he went balls deep on his daughter. But yeah, those photos are still up there if you want to take a look at them. If you're not into gory stuff, I'd say stay away. That's my advice. The last picture he posted with the caption, "Would you like it rare?" just made me want to vomit. You know, seriously, he's going to have to wear oven mitts if he insists on being on TV for the next few months. There is a pay-per-view this weekend, which may well be over by the time you listen to this, but I just want to run through the lineup real quick. Slammiversary from Boston. Again, they're down to four pay-per-views now, so this is one of their big shows. Bully Ray and Sting in the main event for the TNA title. No holds barred. If Sting loses, he never again challenges for the championship. I'm going to go with Bully Ray in this match. I just think it's way too premature to take the title off him. They certainly have been teasing a Brooke Hogan heel turn. I think it may be early. I think they may want to kind of drag that out a few more months. If she did turn heel or in some way cost Sting this match, wouldn't shock me in the least. But Bully is my pick. Kurt Angle and AJ Styles should have, if they give them time, should have a pretty kick-ass match. I'm going to go with AJ. It's my prediction in that match. There's a four-way for the tag team titles. Chavo and Hernandez defending against Daniels and Kazarian, Aries and Rude, and the team of James Storm and Gunner. And it is an elimination rules match, so it may be a long match. Maybe this is just me wanting them to win, but I'm going to go with Aries and Rude in this match, even though I have a funny feeling Chavo and Hernandez may retain. But I'm going to go with Aries and Rude as my picks to win the belts. D-Von defends the television title against Joseph Park. I'm going to go with Joe Park winning his first championship. It's not like D-Von's done anything with this belt. Kenny King defends the X Division title against Chris Sabin and Suicide in an Ultimate X match. Boy, are they tempting fate by putting Chris Sabin in an Ultimate X match. A guy that's blown out both of his ACLs. In fact, his first match back from the other ACL injury was him doing a tope through the ropes. He landed on the outside and he blew out his other ACL. And he just came back a few weeks ago, and you're going to put him in an Ultimate X match that requires people to climb high wires, high above the ring. I don't know that that's such a great idea. Kenny King's my pick to retain. Samoa Joe and Magnus will team up with the returning Jeff Hardy to take on Wes Briscoe, Garrett Bischoff, and Doc, the apparently unbreakable Doc, and we'll get to that in a second, from Aces and Eights. I'm going to go with Joe, Magnus, and Hardy as my pick. Gail Kim and Taryn Terrell in a last knockout standing match. I can't ever remember there being a last man standing match with two women's wrestlers, so this will be a first, at least for me. I figure Taryn Terrell goes over in this match. And Jay Bradley will meet Sam Shaw in a match that absolutely nobody will care about because they've given us no reason to give a shit. They will meet to determine what former Gut Check competitor will enter the Bound for Glory series, which in theory gives either Jay Bradley or Sam Shaw a chance to become the TNA champion. So Jay Bradley and his boomstick, I assume, go over in this match. And they're also going to be announcing the next TNA Hall of Fame inductee. I don't believe they are inducting the person. They are going to announce who it is, and the actual induction will take place Bound for Glory weekend in October. A lot of speculation on who this is. To me, there's only one name that makes sense since he didn't go in the first time, and that's Jeff Jarrett, who technically is still with the company, although, boy, they've been doing a lot to phase him out. I wonder if there's still some lingering bad blood from the whole, fiasco when he lied about the fact that he was dating Karen Jarrett and he lied to Dixie Carter. And, I can only assume there must still be some lingering bad blood there because you would never even know Jarrett existed before this week. They finally showed footage of him as part of that Sting promo package, which shocked the hell out of me and makes me think perhaps it's Jeff Jarrett. It could also be, it could be Hulk Hogan. It could be Kurt Angle. Or it could be an original like AJ Styles. The problem is it just doesn't make any sense to do somebody like AJ right now because of the storyline. I'll be honest with you, even though I think Jeff Jarrett deserves to be the person, and I think it's going to be him, it probably, in all honesty, should be Dixie's dad, Bob Carter, because without his money, without his millions and millions of dollars, this company would not be around to celebrate its 11th anniversary. So you want to put somebody deserving in the Hall of Fame, you put Bob Carter in that Hall of Fame, because without him, there is no TNA. Which brings me to another anniversary I almost completely forgot about this week. Impact was back in its old 9 p.m. time slot on Thursday. It was 1 year ago, almost to the day, May 31st, 2012, that Impact made the move to 8 p.m. and made the move to go live each and every Thursday night. It was only supposed to be for the summer, and then Spike extended it. Technically now, Impact isn't even live anymore because it's on like a two-hour delay, so there really is no such thing anymore as live Impact. But Brooke Hogan made her debut on that show on May 31st last year, and that was also when I started watching Impact on a regular basis. So it's my Impact anniversary. Obviously, I watched some TNA before that, but I couldn't stick with it week to week during the Russo era. It was just completely unwatchable. So I decided to give it a chance, and here we are a year later, and I'm still hanging tough. There was a period of time before the Aces and Eights stuff started, and even a few months after, I guess, where I would enjoy Impact more than Raw on some weeks. You know, it was just nice to have another wrestling promotion to follow with some interesting personalities and some good action. I mean, that's really all you can ask for. But I've noticed an alarming pattern over the last few weeks. You know, I don't want to say that the product is slipping back into old habits, because it's not. I mean, that would be unfair. You know, before, there was so much stuff going on, I couldn't keep up. I'd say, you know, 85% of what I was seeing on Impact didn't make any sense. Now, only 50% doesn't make sense. So it's an improvement. But these last few weeks just feel like they're a company coasting. You know, they're a promotion with virtually no momentum right now. I opened the sound off this week by saying Daniel Bryan, this one guy on the WWE roster, has so much momentum. Well, here's an entire promotion that has no momentum. This week's show did little to get me excited for Slammiversary. Again, Kurt Angle and AJ could be a classic. You know, the tag match has the potential to be a lot of fun. That's about it. There's nothing else on this show that excites me. The company, you know, they have some things going for it. You know, they made it to year 11, which is more than most, you know, promotions can say. They finally got out of the Impact zone, and they took the show on the road, which was long overdue. They made that deal with YouTube to start their own channel. That was the deal that WWE turned down in favor of going with Yahoo. So, you know, TNA swooped in, they took it. It's not going to change their fortunes or anything, but it's something nice for them to say they have. You know, 2 weeks ago on this podcast, I answered a mailbag question about what TNA needs to do to build its brand and really make a splash. You know, signing John Cena or CM Punk is not going to happen. Never. Never going to happen. Instead, I talked about how important it is, I think, for TNA to build an awareness of the product and just do a better job at PR, for crying out loud. You know, create a buzz. Do something to get people talking, and not just wrestling fans. You know, wrestling fans aren't the problem. You know, those hardcore wrestling fans who watch Impact, they're going to watch no matter what. And right now, they're doing a really poor job of making people aware of the product and creating a buzz. And it doesn't help that it just feels like the Hulk Hogan vanity show with everything built around him and his daughter. That's not the answer to TNA's woes. It's not the answer to their problems. You know, Hogan's been there now for over 3 years. And ask yourself, has he done more to harm the company, or has he done more to help the company? Ratings and buy rates have not improved. Live event attendance? I mean, not really. It's not like he attends live events anyway, so it's not like he's having an impact by actually showing up at these shows. I'll be honest with you, even if he did, I don't think you're going to sell that many more tickets. People just don't know about TNA. So, again, ratings and buy rates haven't improved. Live event attendance has not improved. So what does that leave? General product awareness. You figure Hogan could really help in that department, but he hasn't. Something has to change, and maybe it starts with Hogan. You know, he's hardly the only problem, but it's a valid question. Is he worth it? This was the second taping this week of Impact that they did last week. You could really tell because, boy, this crowd was just completely burned out. They weren't getting excited about anything on this show. And the big news coming out of it was Dixie Carter announced that Bound for Glory will be taking place in San Diego, California, at the Viejas Arena, October 20th. It'll be TNA's first trip into San Diego for an event. Why haven't they brought a pay-per-view to New York is what I want to know. They had a house show here 5 years ago at Webster Hall. It was the first TNA show I ever attended. For those who don't know, Webster Hall is a very famous dance club venue. It's got a lot of levels. I don't know that they could do a pay-per-view there necessarily. Well, you know what? They could do a pay-per-view there if they wanted to. The point is, they had a nice crowd, a hot crowd. It was in the biggest media market in the country. that first base brawl event they did in Brooklyn 3 years ago, they actually had footage of that on television. I was at that event as well. That was the biggest crowd for a show the company ever did on this side of the Atlantic, up to that point anyway. These guys need to do a pay-per-view in New York. Speaking of Dixie, she was at it again on Twitter, hyping that, this is what she says, the ink is just drying on a big free agent that will rock Impact on Spike TV. Tune in and join us on this summer adventure. I have no idea when this person will debut. I have no idea who the person is. My first instinct was to say Rob Van Dam, who is a free agent now and is reportedly leaning towards going back to TNA as opposed to going back to WWE. But to me, to hype an announcement like this for a guy who's already been with your company for the past 3 or 4 years and has largely been relegated to the mid-card for the last year or so, for it to be him would be a huge letdown, as many of Dixie's past surprises that she's hyped on Twitter have been. So I sure hope it's a big deal, whoever it is. It's not The Rock, for those who have asked, perhaps in jest. I hope in jest. I hope nobody actually thinks it's The Rock, because she used the word rock in her tweet. It's not Dave Bautista, you know, MVP, went on Twitter and says it's not him. I guess it could be somebody like a Shelton Benjamin or a John Morrison, although WWE.com actually just did an interview not too long ago with Morrison, so I doubt that. You know, maybe it's a hot indie name. Maybe it's somebody from Ring of Honor or somebody we're not thinking of. Or maybe, you know what? Maybe they're going to go all in with the Hogan family drama and they've signed Nasty Nick Hogan. I'm surprised they haven't brought him in already, to be honest with you. Sting and Joe Park on this show beat Team 3D. Abyss's music played. So, like an idiot, Bully Ray walked down the aisleway to confront the monster. So, two idiot champions on TV this week. John Cena and Bully Ray basically doing the same thing. It was just a distraction, of course. Sting hit the Scorpion Death Drop on D-Von and pinned him. We had the Dixie segment in the ring that I mentioned where she made the announcement about Bound for Glory. Garrett Bischoff, Wes Briscoe, and Doc came out to terrorize this poor woman before Magnus and Samoa Joe finally came out to save her. This segment was baffling. First of all, kudos to Joe and Magnus for having enough foresight to save their boss when apparently nobody else in the back could be bothered to do the same thing. But the other part of this was seeing Doc standing at ringside with a nice big grin on his face, looking none the worse for wear after being hit in the face with a hammer by AJ Styles last week. My suspension of disbelief was severely challenged here in this segment. And I had somebody on Twitter, when I said that, bring up, you know, Triple H's use of the sledgehammer and ask, well, isn't that ridiculous too? Yeah, it is. I'm with you on that. I'm not going to disagree. Wrestling absurdity knows no boundaries. It does not discriminate based on company initials. WWE, TNA, you know, they both have me saying WTF more often than they probably should. At least Triple H isn't as casual in his use of the sledgehammer. He doesn't use it every single week, multiple times on every single show. The sledgehammer gimmick at least is over. And you wonder why Aces and Eights isn't. I was trying to think of another example in wrestling of something that was used as like a gimmick, whether it's an object or a move, that actually got over and was very effective. And I thought of Randy Orton's punt kick, which we saw recently. Now, I know the punt has been banned. They did let him use it on Big Show at Extreme Rules, but I think that was just a one-time deal. Before that, he had not used that kick in forever. But when Orton would use the punt kick, people reacted to it big time, even when he was just setting up for it, because they knew that if he nails you in the head, there's a pretty good chance we weren't going to see that person for a while. They treated it like a big deal, and they trained the fans to realize that when a dude gets kicked in the head by Randy Orton, he's probably not going to show up the next week smiling like nothing ever happened. They were kind of doing that in the beginning. They put Sting out of action, did Aces and Eights for a little bit. They put Magnus out of action. They put Eric Young out of action. But now, it's just beyond absurd. I don't even know why I let this bother me so much. I think it's because after they finally did the turn with Bully at Lockdown, like that first week when they came out on Impact, I thought I had turned a corner on this Aces and Eights stuff. I thought, okay, they finally got somebody in there who can talk for the group. You know, with Bully, I knew he was just an awesome talker and a great heel. So I was ready to keep an open mind and actually like this aces and eights nonsense. I thought maybe, okay, this is going to be the start of something, finally, with these guys. Even after all those months of aces and eights losing every single match on television, maybe they're finally going to do something here. And it didn't take long before I realized, nope, nothing's changed. It's still just a bunch of rejects that nobody cares about. You know, maybe Wes Briscoe can be something someday. Garrett, he looks good. That's about the only nice thing I can say about him. Knox, Doc, they're big. That's about it. They're prelim guys. D'Lo Brown, his time is come and gone. He's just there in a supporting role. Mr. Anderson, I have no use for. When they announced it was going to be Anderson and AJ in the main event this week, I just rolled my eyes. I find the guy as exciting as a test pattern. And then you have Bully and Devon, who've been around forever. They're already established guys. Bully's the champion, and I think that's cool, but I'm trying to figure out what the end game is here with aces and eights. Like, what's the purpose? Who are they building? I look at wrestling factions over the last few years. The main event mafia in TNA. The main event mafia was just that. It was a collection of top guys. And that's fine. It was in the damn name of the group. We knew exactly what those guys were supposed to be. With the Nexus, they were trying to make a bunch of new guys. Now, whether it was successful or not is another story, but they tried. And a bunch of those guys, they are now on TV in other roles. You know, Wade Barrett's going to be a world champion one day. Ryback is fighting for the title right now. You look at The Shield. All three of those guys can be world champion or WWE champion one day. They're part of the future of that company. Who from Aces and Eights is the future of TNA? If they had one or two guys who could be that person and they were building to that, you could almost excuse all the nonsense. But they don't have anybody, so what's the point? Samoa Joe beat Garrett Bischoff by DQ before everybody ran in, which sets up that six-man tag for the pay-per-view, and Jeff Hardy's return on Joe and Magnus's team. James Storm did an interview backstage explaining why he chose Gunner to be his partner at the pay-per-view. It's because Gunner served in the military and has killed people before. This is what James Storm said. Gunner has killed people for his country, and now he can kill people for me. Good. Maybe he can do this country a great service and kill off this Aces and Eights storyline, too. That would make him a fine patriot in my book. Storm and Gunner teamed with Hernandez and Chavo, defeating Bad Influence, Bobby Roode, and Austin Aries in an eight-man tag. Aries actually submitted to Gunner for the finish, which was kind of interesting to see. Aries do a clean submission loss here, being a former world champion and all. This was also Aries' first match on TV since the Christy Hemme incident. So I guess make of that what you will. I'm still going with them to win at the pay-per-view. Mickie James came out with her new Knockouts title, acting way over the top as a babyface, so much so that she basically was acting like a heel. She called out Velvet Sky, who had her knee all taped up. Velvet appreciated all the nice things that Mickie was saying about her, but business is business, she said. She wants her rematch. And Mickie said she had no problem with this, and Velvet can wait until her knee is 100% and they would tear the house down. But apparently healing up for her big rematch was of no concern to Velvet. She said she wanted her rematch at Slammiversary. You know, it's hard for me to have sympathy for Velvet when she insists on being stupid. Why wouldn't she agree and say, you know what, you're right, I'm going to heal up, I'm going to wait until I'm 100%, and then I'm going to kick your ass and take my belt back. Why would she insist on wrestling with a bum wheel, basically wrestling on one leg? That's pretty much why she lost to Mickie James in the first place. Anyway, Mickie said, listen, Brooke Hogan already booked Gail and Taryn for the pay-per-view, so it's not going to happen. Gail Kim came out. She attacked Velvet's knee. She teased doing the figure four around the post. Taryn Terrell came out to chase her away. And Mickie James just stood there and did nothing to help. Chris Sabin and Taryn Terrell beat Kenny King and Gail Kim in a mixed tag after Sabin pinned King, and King attacked Sabin with the belt after the match. Suicide ran down to make the save, and then we probably had the best segment on the entire show. A pre-taped sit-down interview backstage with Sting, talking about some of the biggest title victories from his career. He mentioned the Great American Bash in 1990 over Ric Flair. He mentioned beating Hulk Hogan in that horrendous Starrcade match. Kurt Angle, he mentioned Jeff Jarrett as well. No mention of Vader, which disappointed me, since Vader was probably his best opponent. Those were some of the best battles of Sting's career. But this was a very good way to hype what will perhaps be his final title match heading into the pay-per-view. Main event was AJ and Anderson. AJ looked good, but this match just died a death. Nobody cared. Crowd was silent. Finish was terrible with Kurt Angle just running out and attacking AJ for the DQ. If he wanted him so badly, why not just run out at the beginning and spare us these 12 minutes? That's what I say. Aces and Eights guys came down at this point. Joe Park, Magnus, Sting, everybody ran out. Just one big giant brawl. Sting got Bully in the Scorpion Deathlock. D-Von broke it up. They laid out Sting with a reverse 3D, and Aces and Eights stood tall at the end of the show. So this show coming up, the pay-per-view, is one that's going to really tell the tale as far as how well TNA's new pay-per-view strategy works now that they only have four shows a year. It's been a couple of months now since lockdown. They don't have another show until Bound for Glory after this. So we're going to see if their new strategy pays off, and if their buys double, then maybe they're on to something, and if they don't, well, it's just more of the same, I guess, for TNA. Let's get to the mailbag. You can always email me your questions at thesolemonster@gmail.com. Ben from England writes in, "My question is about bringing Prestige back to the World Heavyweight title. Would it not make sense to put the WWE title on Ryback at Payback? John Cena can lose one more match, ending the feud, and keep the title on Ryback. Then have Cena go on to chase Ziggler for the World Heavyweight Championship, maybe even win it, and have CM Punk chase Ryback. This way, the two top stars are in title feuds. Plus, it keeps Punk and Cena away from each other. So long as they have two titles, and the WWE title is their top belt, the World Heavyweight Championship is never going to have the prestige that you're asking for. You know, it's just not. And I'm over the whole Ryback thing. I thought it would have made sense to put the title on him at Extreme Rules and then have Cena chase him and get it back. But now, you know, Ryback's lost so many times. He had the one match with Cena. He didn't win. I'm over it. I'd rather have Daniel Bryan get the next shot. Start building to him as the next number one contender. Keep the title on Cena. Book the match at SummerSlam. You know, Bryan versus Ziggler would also be pretty cool. But I'd like to see Bryan in the top program for a change. And the reality is, Bryan versus Ziggler, while it may make for some awesome matches, is not going to be the top program. Whatever John Cena is in is going to be a number one. And that's what Bryan should be involved with. And Ryback should just move on to something else because they've blown it with him as far as I'm concerned. This comes from Robert. "After the Lesnar-Triple H cage match from Extreme Rules, I was reminded of something that has always bothered me with cage matches. Why is the door an option for escape? Nearly every cage match has a point where one wrestler stares at the door, tells the ref to open it, and then proceeds to walk towards the door very slowly. Never understood why anyone would even consider trying to climb out when it takes a matter of seconds to sprint for the door and jump out. Have cage matches always used the door? If not, at what point did escaping through the door become a viable means of escape, and why was the method added?" Well, I don't understand how slowly walking towards the cage door is any different than a wrestler climbing slowly up a ladder. If anything, I think that's even more ridiculous. You know, when you got a guy who's down on the mat, and you got another guy in a ladder match who's already halfway up the ladder, and he's got to start selling that he's hurt, he can't climb, he's waiting for the other guy to get up. To me, that's even more ridiculous than this. They both look equally ridiculous, to be honest with you. Actually, now that I think about it, they're both pretty stupid. But that's wrestling. That's just how it is. You know, I've always assumed the door was used as a means of exit because you weren't going to have somebody, for example, like Andre the Giant back in the day climbing over the top of the cage. Probably would be a bad idea. And back then, wrestling was full of monsters, far more than now. I mean, you've got guys now like Lesnar, Ryback, and Mark Henry, but back then, everybody was just gigantic. These guys, these massive 300-400-pound guys who either couldn't, wouldn't, or it just would have been a bad idea to have them climb 10, 15 feet in the air. Even a guy like Bruno Sammartino back in the day, you know, did he ever win any cage matches by climbing out over the top? I don't remember him doing that. Maybe he did. But those guys were either, you know, too afraid to climb that high, or they just said, no, I'm not going to do it. And the cage door, therefore, was a much more viable means for a big guy to exit. I assume that was the genesis of it. Luis from Illinois, "Do you think the next inductee into the TNA Hall of Fame could be the Poffo family, just so TNA could stick it to WWE again like they did with Sting last year?" I don't think that's why TNA put Sting in their Hall of Fame. I don't think their idea was, well, we'll put him in the Hall of Fame first because WWE hasn't, and therefore, you know, ha-ha, we have Sting in our Hall of Fame. I think Sting's been there now for a whole bunch of years. They value his whatever it is that he brings to the product. They're very loyal to him. He's loyal to TNA, and they wanted to reward that by putting a big name in there. I don't think it was any way to kind of stick it to WWE. If it was, they're fools, because I don't think WWE gave a shit. And I think putting the Poffo family in would be ridiculous. I mean, just completely, totally ludicrous. People don't want to see Randy Savage in the TNA Hall of Fame. They want to see him properly honored by the company where he made a name for himself on a national stage, the place he's most associated with, the place where he made the most money, and that's WWE. You know, his lone appearance in TNA back in 2004 was forgettable. It was sad. It was something that, quite frankly, never should have happened. He could barely move, as we found out in that great article that Keith Elliott Greenberg did a few weeks ago for Bleacher Report. I mean, he had a whole bunch of injuries, obviously. His knees were all messed up, but the biggest injury of his career came after he retired. It was when he filmed Spider-Man. He got dumped on his head. So with his neck all messed up, he could barely move. He never should have been out there in the first place. He looked terrible. And apparently, his time in TNA, as brief as it was, he acted like a total prima donna. He got the pinfall in that match, no less. It was like, I think it was a six-man tag. All Savage did was just walk out, and I think he rolled up AJ Styles or whoever it was, and he was going to get a title match, and he wanted the championship. So he acted like a total prima donna. I mean, is that what they would show in his induction video? Him walking to the ring, looking like a crippled shell of his former self? They're going to show that, and they're going to show a whole bunch of still shots from Pro Wrestling Illustrated? What are they going to put in his video? I think that's a terrible idea. Jesse from Arizona, if social media existed during the 90s, would companies like WCW and ECW still be around today? Instead of trying to find a network to run their television show, maybe they could find an audience on YouTube. Would that be a good enough platform to make money producing a television show? No, because without TV, they would have been dead. If it were a temporary thing, like let's say a matter of weeks, we're going to put the show on YouTube while we kind of get all of our ducks in a row, and then we're going to make a big splash on FX or USA or TBS, that'd be one thing. But you can't run a company like ECW or WCW and pay your expenses and pay all your talent without having a TV deal in place. It just wouldn't have worked. Lastly here, Quinn writes in. He calls himself a curious fan. I wonder what he's curious about. For about a year now, I felt that WWE programming has been shot like crap. What's with all these quick zooms into finishers that result in not seeing the finish at all? Instead, we see a close-up of a person's face. When they have a spot with a superstar jumping to the outside, the guy is always jumping into the shot, as opposed to a medium shot of the ring showing the distance that the superstar cleared. Obviously, Quinn here is very familiar with his camera terms. Showing John Cena crashing into the ring steps, but showing the shot of him pushing the stairs, as opposed to catching the opposite side that makes it look like he took the hit with impact. I feel like this 26 camera system just makes the show damn near unwatchable. Why can't they just keep the majority of the action shot from the camera side? Am I the only person bothered by this? No, you're not. I'm actually glad you brought up them shooting guys coming off the apron into the shot instead of taking a wider view. They do this a lot with Daniel Bryan and that knee off the apron. You know, that may look real cool if Raw ever goes 3D, but I agree. It's very annoying. That and the damn shaky cam they still insist on using whenever the Shield comes out for an attack. It's a Kevin Dunn specialty, and it sucks, and I wish he would stop. You know, maybe his parents shook him violently as a young woodchuck, and so now he feels the need to make everybody else nauseous as well. WWE's production values are the best. You know, they're the best in the business, but I agree, though. They have some quirks that probably need to be worked out. If you have questions for the mailbag, again, you can always email me at thesolomonster@gmail.com. Follow me on Twitter 24/7, @solomonster. And friend us on Facebook, facebook.com/thesolomonster. Send a friend request. I will approve you. You can be part of all the lively banter and debate that goes on there each and every week. And don't forget, subscribe to The Sound Off as well in iTunes. So that's going to do it for this week. Thanks for tuning in to episode 276. It's a beautiful day outside. I'm going to go out and take advantage of it. You should, too, wherever you are. We'll see you right back here next week for 277 right here on SEScoops.com. Until then, be well, stay safe. See you back here next week.
Let me tell you something, fella.
This is Joel from Northern Ireland.
I am AJ Grimaldo.
And quite simply, the fastest 60 minutes on the internet.
The Solar Monster sounds off on scoops.com.